Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black. And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments, what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rep Bray.
We'll talk about wellness, is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness, and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address, either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership. I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers, they make things happen, and sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long-term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of LA doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of LA where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, is to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you're in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components, we take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients, and there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different, every background is different, every family makeup is different, every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them, you can follow them, you can retweet things that they're sending, and you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
Of all the things that can happen on the way to the sale of your business, having a deal fall apart because of sloppy financials is probably the worst. Here's expert Addison Adams.
In the sale of a company, you are in a very cooperative process with the other side. If you're the seller of the business and the buyer is coming in and evaluating whether to buy your business, there needs to be a high level of trust there. A trust that you are not only being open and honest about your business and what you know about it, but also credibility that you know what you're talking about. And that when you hand over your financial statements, for example, they're clean, they're correct, they're complete, and they're not misleading. Preferably they're audited, and not only currently audited, but going back several years. And this is so that there is a confidence that comes in from the point of view of the buyer.
You're the trustee of your company's 401k or profit sharing plan. You have certain responsibilities. What can happen when things go wrong? We ask Buck Blanton.
We have a responsibility when we run qualified plans as a business owner, or in that world we call it a plan sponsor. That person has a responsibility of due care and due loyalty to the participant. And sometimes we forget that when we run plans and we do other things. But as you said, those breaches can become kind of onerous. The 2013 audit year, there were 3,566 audits performed by the Department of Labor, and more than $2.7 billion with a B dollars in fines and penalties were levied. All of those things can be done and levied against corporate officers personally. It's not your corporate seat that might get sued or levied. It's going to be you personally.
What are some of the biggest challenges facing family businesses in their management transition? We ask Transition Consulting Group's David and Paul Karofsky for their thoughts regarding this topic.
As the baby boomers are coming of age and getting a little bit older, as the next generation is starting to get a little bit older and come into that leadership position, this transfer of not only monetary wealth, but you're talking about the businesses, the assets, whatever it might be, there needs to be a plan to transfer that seamlessly. To my dad's point, the more planning you do and you talk about it as to what that transition of ownership looks like, what is that transition of leadership? Those two are not the same. They can be similar in tie, but they can be mutually exclusive as well. But until you really have a plan as to how you transfer that business from one generation to the next, it's very difficult to do it.
When a parent passes away, sometimes dealing with mom or dad's effects can be challenging. Here's senior real estate expert Allison Whitaker.
There's different levels of sorting through things, and so we work with organizers and professional inventory people, estate sale planners. Basically, they come in and they will help you sort, is this a donation pile? Is this a for sale pile? Are these items things that we need to send off to our auction house in London to get appraised and actually auction off? There's different auction houses as well, not just Sotheby's, if it's sports memorabilia, you know, that we would recommend using. There's also that element of, is it a good time to sell the house when it comes to taxes? Taxes are a whole nother conversation, and a lot of times people think, well, the market's up, we should just sell the house, but there could be some tax ramifications depending upon the way the estate has been set up, that maybe it's better to rent it out for a couple years.
How would an attorney specializing in professionals handle a case differently? We asked Miranda McCroskey.
A young man came to me with an allegation of a hit and run, and he was looking at jail time. Going to jail was going to be a big problem for a lot of reasons. So I provided the district attorney with all the mitigating factors, all the factors that they could consider in determining his sentence. And I stressed to the DA the consequences of the criminal conviction on this young man. And the benefit is he was able to do a diversion program, which means avoiding the conviction entirely. The less obvious benefit was that he avoided the criminal conviction that would have affected his path because he wanted to be a physical therapist. From the application process to the physical therapy board, through the renewals that each board has, he would have had to bring that conviction up year after year and discuss that. And so he got to avoid all of that.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
With all the social media platforms to choose from, why has YouTube become so popular? We asked Joan Pounds.
The younger generations do a lot more visually. So a lot of times your YouTube videos and things like that are better ways to reach out to them. I found out through my son, actually, who's a teenager, that YouTube is the second largest search engine in the world. And I had no idea. I never even thought about going to YouTube to find out how to do something. And the beauty about YouTube is we can create our own videos right now from our phones and upload them to YouTube. And the neat thing about that is you're creating your own celebrity during that time. People buy from those they know, like, and trust. And that's one way for people to reach out, begin to know you and to like you and to trust you.
Family businesses can be very challenging sometimes. Here's Roseanne Levy from the Roark Group.
What I tell people is think about your family and think about working with them. We address many issues of families who work together and really help them resolve them. What are they dealing with? What are their major issues? And, you know, just from there, we, you know, work with the family, work with all members of the family. Of course, all the family members have to be in agreement to say, okay, we want to make this better. We want it to work, because God knows in many cases they're not interested in cooperating and they each go their own way, and then the business tends to not thrive. So we're very much on top of what families go through. And I did have one member, I love to share this, who said, gosh, if we could only learn to run our businesses with our heads and not our hearts, we'd be a lot more successful. So that's always stayed with me, and it's really the truth.
John Murphy and David Horwich help business owners think like business buyers. Here's some of the common things that they see out there.
We tend to find many of the same things. We look at management. We look at the financial foundation. How good are the numbers, both historically and in the future? We look at the growth. What we often find is business owners spend too much money on growth. They plant a lot of seeds, and they plant too many seeds because they don't take enough time sometimes up front to determine what are the criteria they should use to judge the seeds, so they kind of plant a lot.
Another common theme that's been running through a lot of our clients over the last year or so has been sales operations and sales strategy and sales operations and development. A lot of companies that we've been working with, they're stalled out in growth and they're not sure why. And what we have found in taking a good hard look at them is that they don't have a great sales strategy in place. So we help them assess that, put that in place, and then get it going.
Today's topic is about cost reduction, specifically LED lighting. Here's Chaz Dykes.
LED lights are something in the neighborhood of 70% more efficient. So it's a substantial, very significant savings. Whenever I explain our program of cost reduction through LED retrofit, people say, oh yeah, that's exactly like what they're doing with the solar panels. And I'll tell you what, it's really very, very different than that. What people fail to understand is that if you go with the solar projects for your house and you have the panels put on, you don't own those panels. The company owns those panels, and you're just leasing them.
Oh. That,
the company goes in and goes to the feds and to the local government and gets
credits.
All of those credits and all those rebates. They do. With my program, you own the lights. You get all of that savings in addition to the reduced cost.
Okay, so you're ready to start your exit plan. We asked for three quick tips from Stacy McKibben.
Get your number. What is it that you're retiring to or that you're working towards? Understand what that is. That'll help your team to be able to help you to work backwards from that. So know that number and be prepared. Two is look around at your team. Core values of a company are exuded and exemplified by their team. More often than not, the challenges that I see in profitability are due to the fact of lack of productivity by the team. Lastly is run your business like you drive your car. car. You look at your car with a dashboard, you would get in a car and you would make sure that you had enough gas, that there was no check engine light on. All of those same things apply in your business. Do you have a clear dashboard? Do you understand how to read it? You don't need to be an accountant, but you do need to understand what the numbers are, and that is the health radiant of a business.
Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us once again today. Always a pleasure to have you with me. And, you know, I have some great guests that come on and talk about a wide variety of topics. You can find it all at ExitCoachRadio.com or wherever you listen to podcasts, just look for Exit Coach Radio. My first guest today is Jim Mosquera from Sentinel Consulting. And Jim's firm, Sentinel Consulting, is an alternative business and consumer finance firm that also assists firms with debt restructuring. And today we're going to be talking about financing alternatives for small and mid-sized businesses. So, Jim, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, Bill. Appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure, Jim. I've been looking into your what you do, and it's always of interest to our listeners who are, you know, small and mid-sized, closely held business owners. They're always wondering, you know, do I have the right mix, or do I need, you know, where do I go for my financing? And that's the business that you're in. But tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you got started and what Sentinel Consulting does.
Well, one thing that's a little unusual about me is I'm not originally from the United States. My country of birth was actually Panama, and that would mean that my first language was actually Spanish. So Spanish was my first language before English. Academically, I've mentioned this because it has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about. I actually have 2 degrees in industrial engineering, and my master's thesis dealt with something called operations research, which was a fancy way of, you know, using applied math to solve business problems. My professional background was primarily cut in telecom and technology. I had a variety of responsibilities there, including sales of product development. I actually had a chance to develop a patent, be awarded a patent when I was there, did some training and technical consultation. While I was in my professional career in the tech industry, I actually started trading commodity futures for my own account, developed some software to help me trade. Went even as far as to acquire what's called a Series 3 certification to become what's called a commodity trading advisor. These would be people that might advise hedge funds. And then slowly over time, I started developing more knowledge on my own of the financial markets and the economy. It led me to have an online column with an organization called Examiner.com. And then that developed into a newsletter where I could get a little bit more in depth on, you know, financial and economic topics. Then it led to a book series that I produce, nonfiction dealing with the financial markets, you know, economics, investing. And then my most recent book really kind of talks about how those things affect society and our politics as well. Then from that, I developed a fictional series that deals with, you know, it's a political thriller, has cyber terror, it's financial crisis, of course. And it's kind of a neat story that has the main character is a journalist, and then he gets shepherded along by some of his mentors. And it primarily, the book series deals with kind of the nation's struggle with statism and liberty. But what I noticed in that progression of my career, around the time of the financial crisis, which is around the time that I started writing that column that I mentioned, I understood that the banking industry was going to change and funding for small businesses was going to change as well. And so the financial crisis of 2008 ushered in a period of changes in lending standards and perhaps even more importantly, regulation. That really change the outlook of the commercial banking industry, not so much because they weren't going to lend, because if you were what would consider be an ache type credit, your lending probably didn't change very much at all. In fact, you ended up with some really, really nice rates as short and long-term interest rates fell. But it was that, it's that other swath of, let's say, entrepreneurs and companies that maybe were just a few years old that then were probably going to be a little bit more challenged. And so those firms were going to need advice on not just the funding, but, you know, the sources of fundings themselves. When I first got started in the business, which I started this company, Sentinel Consulting, in 2014, I really focused a lot of the practice on helping firms deal with debt challenges via restructuring and mediation services. I'm located in the St. Louis, Missouri metropolitan area, and I found many, many companies that were in civil litigation due to debt problems, and there's different approaches on how to handle that, and some of them, honestly, I shouldn't say some of them, most of them weren't really handling them in the right way. What I tried to do with the practice was to provide, let's say, a very skinny Chapter 11 like restructuring process. It's not Chapter 11 because we're not going through, you know, a court appointed, you know, financing, mediation, and things of that nature. And the reality is that companies that are under $50 million are not going to go through a Chapter 11 process because of the complexity and cost. So what we try to do is provide some of that same discipline without the rigors of Chapter 11. So the firm Sentinel Consulting really deals with alternative financing that would potentially replace or maybe be complementary to commercial banking. Secondly, restructuring services when companies find themselves in debt. And then something that's a little bit newer for the firm, which is consumer financing. So financing for those businesses, customers who sometimes those customers don't have that immediate cash on hand to, you know, buy the goods and services, as has been related by recent surveys by both the Federal Reserve and AAA, actually, and then other customers that would frankly appreciate having a finance plan available, you know, for the goods and services that they purchase.
Yeah, it's a great background and very interesting niche that you carved out there. And I know, you know, around that the time when the economic crisis was happening back in 2008, 2009, and the years following that, a lot of small and mid-sized businesses owners found themselves with kind of the banks were turning their back on them because things tightened up so much. And now, you know, we're 10 years past all that. What's the environment today for this? Is it still difficult? And do people still need to look into a lot of alternatives? And if so, what alternatives should they look at for their financing these days in small and mid-sized businesses?
Well, as you would imagine, and you just said, we're 10 years, maybe even 11 years from the bottom of the financial crisis, and things obviously have gotten markedly better in the economy from a lending perspective as well. But there are some things that small business owners need to be aware of, though, if they're going to approach a commercial bank. You know, and one of the things is the age of their business. If your business typically isn't maybe a couple or 3 years old, that's something that is going to be a flag, if you will, for the commercial banking industry. Litigation, you know, have you been the subject of litigation, either you're as a plaintiff or as a defendant? That's something that, you know, can create some issues. You know, what's your profitability been? So there's a number of things that are there. But, you know, one of the things that I do is, in terms of an industry update, is I track the economy very, very closely, as well as the financial markets. In fact, I write a column for an online financial journal that's primarily used by investors. But the things that I write about are, you know, the macro economy as a whole. And there are many signs right now of a softening economy combined with very, very over-leveraged business enterprises. Though when I say that, those are typically larger firms that I don't deal with that have been able to borrow, not through lending vehicles like my own, but maybe they're able to go into the credit markets and with bond issues and so forth. And such that there's been a deteriorating credit quality. And if some of your listeners are familiar with ratings of debt, you know, triple B rated debt is the tier that is, let's say, just the lowest tier from an investment grade standpoint. Anything below that is considered junk debt. And really right now, that triple B rated credit market is larger, you know, than it's ever been. And that pristine debt, that's that debt that's rated AAA, has shrunk significantly, again, since the start of the last financial crisis, 2008. And so one of the things that does is it creates a much more precarious environment as interest rates start to change. And I published something in an article recently that showed how many firms that, again, that are in that triple B rating, are having to just continually raise money in order to finance their old debts. Well, they're not profitable, and they're still able to raise money to do that. You know, the only institution that I know that can continue to refund old, refinance old debts in that fashion is the United States government. Well, these companies aren't the United States government. So one of the things it does is creates, you know, it creates much more credit stress. And one of the, we are seeing actually some of the effects of that and some of the things I talk about in my books where, you know, you've got an increasing, you know, caustic political environment. You know, you're going to have a deteriorating social mood. That's going to usher in, you know, some economic challenges, and business need to understand that because you're going to be going into a much tougher credit environment in the near future.
Yeah, it seems like, and again, we're seeing as we speak, you know, interest rates coming down and the Fed saying they're going to be buying back treasuries and debts and keeping interest rates low and avoiding interest rate increases. Do you think that's because of the fragility of the economy, or it's just not jump starting, or what's your take on that?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. And one of the things that I write about either in column writing or writing my books is that there's this notion that the Fed tends to be ahead of the market. And the reality is, and I could show people charts that show that the Fed actually reacts to what the markets are doing. And the Fed controls one interest rate. And what they did that was a little bit different during the financial crisis is they tried to control that interest rate, but they went into the market and actively bought a bunch of stuff. And that stuff, you know, was mortgage debt, treasury debt, and so forth. And you have central banks across the world that are doing more than that even. They're actually being active participants in stock markets, as an example. You know, you've got foreign central banks that buy U.S. stocks. I would caution your listeners into thinking that, you know, just because the Fed says they're going to do these things that they've got complete control of the financial markets. And that's really somewhat of a myth that I do explore in some detail in my nonfiction books. The market really does has control. And the credit markets are among the credit markets and the currency markets are among the largest markets in the world. And I would just tell you that because of the amount of debt that the United States has right now from a public perspective, I mentioned earlier how much how fragile, if you will, this triple B rated credit is. When you get a few of those failures that occur, you're going to see upward pressure on interest rates. And I'm not predicting, I'm not telling you that I know exactly what the interest rate's going to be in the near future, but I would say that there's much more pressure for interest rates going up than there is for going down, absent some significant measure that the Federal Reserve would have to take, which, again, I'm not saying that they couldn't do it, but it would be something far more extraordinary than what they've done before.
Yeah, it certainly feels to me, and I'm no expert, but it certainly feels to me like the Feds, it used to be, like you said, they would create or drive the market, and it seems like they just are you know, trying things out to see what happens. See, you know, let's see if the pump is primed for the economy, and then the stock market falls, and they say, well, doesn't feel like it's weak or strong enough yet, so it seems very reactionary,
and that's
scary.
Yeah, and you just used the word, and I want to highlight a word that you just used, and I'm glad you used that word. You said they're trying to do this and that. And really, a lot of what you've seen since 2008 with their massive intervention in the credit markets, it has been really a grand experiment. And unfortunately, as I mentioned in the intro, that you've seen this, you know, you've seen the political environment change in the United States, and you're going to see it change more because one of the things that, you know, Main Street has seen is, well, wait a second, Fed, you guys went and did this, 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 and this. Wow, everything looks great on Wall Street, but how has it helped me, right? And that's why I talk about those things in some detail in my book so people really understand what's going on. And that's why the books are called Escaping Oz, and then they have a different subtitle because, you know, we've been dealing with this wizard fallacy that they're in control when, you know, they're not necessarily in control.
Yeah, and, you know, one question a lot of our listeners that are baby boomers are asking is, okay, well, this is, you know, this has been great from a business standpoint, from a borrowing standpoint, but as a consumer, you know, when am I going to be able to see a decent, safe rate on my money, in the investment world? And it looks like we're, I thought we were heading back towards that, but it seems like we're going to have more retraction and low interest rates, and that's not good for the person who's looking for their investment income.
That's right, and that's one thing that the Fed has done is, you know, the Fed and other central banks, because of their intervention policies, they have absolutely destroyed and decimated what it is to get, as you just mentioned, a safe rate of return for savers. They have really, really put the screws to pension funds, both, you know, especially the private pension funds and some of the public pension funds as well, that are used to making assumptions about earning 8%. Well, they weren't doing that, and then they had to go into riskier ventures, which, you know, when that, you know, when there's fractures in those markets, that's going to be a calamitous event for a lot of these pension funds.
Yeah, that's a scary notion that so many investors, and I'll put it, you know, listeners, I'll put it in simple terms. You know, when you get your 401k statement, you look down towards the bottom where the bond and money market rates are, and you go, well, I can't make any money there. So people start crawling further and further up into the outer branches of risk and getting into riskier and riskier ventures to try to get some yield. And of course, we all know what happens when that reverses. It's a very dangerous position to be. And the question is, well, you know, how far does that fall when it falls? It's very, very scary. So what advice would you give a business owner who's looking at their situation and wondering whether they should be restructuring their debt these days?
Well, you know, for businesses that are seeking credit, if I just say, you know, three tips, ideas, or precautions, the number one thing that I tell a business is make sure that you have a business plan. And let's qualify it a little bit. There's many lenders that I work with that they don't necessarily care whether you have a business plan or not. Now, if you want to borrow a lot of money, the more money you want to borrow, the more likely it is that you need to either have a business plan or at least be able to articulate your business plan. And even if you don't have a business plan that you necessarily think about from a lending and credit perspective, it's a great management document, right? I mean, it's a blueprint for how you're going to run your business, because maybe you laid it all out at some point in time. And then once you start working, you know, in your business as opposed to on your business, then you kind of forgot some of the things that you did. Something that could be part of a business plan, or it could be a separate document, is a budget. I tell businesses, particularly in early stage part of their life cycle, if you don't have a budget, then how do you know whether you are at? I mean, it's like a gauge, if you will, a dashboard. How do you know if you're where you're supposed to be? And it's another great management tool. I mean, I work for large companies, and, you know, we always had a budget, and you manage to that budget. Small businesses, mid-sized businesses sometimes, you know, tend to get away from that. And as I mentioned, the budget could be part of that business plan that you need to present to a lender, or just simply could be a management document. For, again, early stage companies, build that credit. Either build that credit with your vendors, vendor credit, on credit cards. You know, we have a specific program that we use with early stage companies where we build a credit line for them through an aggregation of credit cards, and to make sure that either your vendor or those credit card companies are reporting to the credit agencies, because if they're not doing that, you may be a great credit risk, but if nobody knows about it, then it's like it doesn't occur. And the other thing final thing I want to mention about the budget is I remember meeting with a couple of companies here in the last couple of years. And I said, do you have a budget? They said, no. And I said, you know, one of the things that I think is important for small businesses to know is, you know, to go back to an old Kenny Rogers song, is to know when to hold up and know when to fold up. I see businesses sometimes that probably shouldn't be in existence anymore, but because they didn't really have a business plan, because they didn't have a budget, they thought, oh, okay, we're just going to go another month and, you know, maybe we'll do better, you know, and even though they're very far off their financial targets. And then what happens? Well, then they may start doing things that are a little bit irregular, like taking out a personal credit card to fund the business, or, you know, dipping into an old 401k or an IRA, or, you know, one very common that I see is, you know, taking out a second mortgage on a house. So it's important to know that, and to have that kind of plan ahead of time. So, you know, it's very possible that your business will not be successful. And that's just something that's important to understand. And I reference that in some of my nonfiction tests and some texts when talking about my investment laws. You got to know when to take a profit, and you also need to know when to take a loss.
Jim, what's the most common question that someone might call you and ask you about?
Well, the first thing they'll say is, you know, can I need to borrow money. Can I get a loan? And that's a very, very generic question that is difficult to answer without some consultation. Again, like, well, how long have you been in business? You know, what's your personal credit score? Is your business profitable? Do you have a bankruptcy in your recent past? Any liens against you or your business? You know, there's kind of a whole constellation of questions that you kind of need to go through. And I do think that even necessarily if it's not a question, there's always the presumption, I think, on the part of many small business owners to think that they can automatically borrow money, which that may or may not be the case. And I take sometimes in presentations, I take people through this exercise to say, hey, have you ever loaned money to somebody just for, you know, personal reasons and so forth? And they will tell me what that experience was like. And you'll get a lot of, you know, interesting comments that come from that. And I say, well, imagine that you're in the business of doing that. Now you see some of the challenges that you face.
Great insights, really, really great speaking with you. Our time's up for today, but if someone were to want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do so?
My business site is Sentinel Consulting, and that's .biz, so it's S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L consulting.biz. My author site, for those that are interested in reading some of that, is actually my last name.com, my first and last name.com, so that's Jim, J-I-M, MOSQUERA.com.
You know, it's very interesting talking with you, and I hope that we can talk again because I think you really have your finger on the pulse of what's going on, and this is a good time for our listeners to be hearing that on a regular basis, Jim. So I hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime soon.
Yeah, great to be on with you.
All right, my next guest today is joined us before. He's an expert in the field of asset protection. His name is Craig Redler from Jeffrey M. Verdon Law Group, and we've talked in the past about asset protection strategies, and he's got some unique experiences in that way. But today we're going to talk about something called personal retirement plans. So, Craig, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me again today.
Thanks, Bill. It's my pleasure to be here.
My pleasure, Craig. We had some great comments from our last interview, and it was really interesting. You have some interesting experiences, but give our listeners a sense of a little bit about your background, who might not have heard the past interview, and the Jeffrey M. Verdon Law Group and what you do there.
Sure. Like I discussed before, it bears repeating. I took an interesting path to get here. I'm originally from the Midwest, practiced law there for decades, and did, making little air quotes here that you can't see on the radio, but routine estate planning. We did bills, trusts, probate, and things like that. And had an opportunity to take a position with an offshore trustee in the Cook Islands, of all places. So moved from St. Louis, Missouri, to Rarotonga in the Cook Islands, which are culturally almost identical. You'd be shocked. And that was a joke.
I got it.
We went right to work for an offshore trustee that specializes in asset protection planning for largely American clients. And learned the biz from that side, and with that company, they ultimately moved me to New Zealand, and I went to work for another company also in New Zealand. So I went from Rarotonga to Tauranga, New Zealand, all these Maori names, and then jumped up to Auckland to work for a bigger company, and ultimately got transferred by that company back to Miami, Florida, where I reacquainted with Jeff. And Jeff is just absolutely one of the giants in asset protection. He's been there since the very beginning of the industry, mm-hmm. was in tight with the people that actually wrote the legislation. The legislation there was written with a lot of input from American attorneys, and Jeff was associated with one of the primary attorneys that put that those statutes together. And if you ask anybody that knows anything about this industry, name the top three asset protection law firms in America, Jeff would be in every one of those conversations. So working here has been an honor, and I thought, boy, over at the Cook Islands, I know everything there is to know about asset protection, and I just didn't. Jeff is just a wizard when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, when they talk about asset protection planning, you know, one of the key tenets of it when you're especially uber wealthy is to make your assets reside far away, or the people that make those decisions reside far away. So the Cook Islands is, I think, when you look on a map, you realize, oh, it's very far away. And how many flights are there to the Cook Islands, correct?
From here, one a week. From the United States,
one a week.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it's all hard to get too much more remote than the Cook Islands.
Now, a lot of people have the misconception that this type of planning is they've heard about offshore trusts and taxes evasion and all that kind of stuff. This isn't about that at all. It's more about putting roadblocks between your assets and your creditors, right?
That's it. It's just sensible planning. It's just a way to make sure that when you retire, you know, if you talk about estate planning, well, estate planning doesn't do any good if you don't have an estate when you retire. So it's all about just making sure that you keep yourself in as financially a healthy a position as you can. And really, in the United States, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know. We're litigation happy here, and a lot of people get sucked into these things and shouldn't be. And I've seen it from the trustee side, and I've seen it since I've been here. And it's just rational and perfectly legal and ethical steps to protect your hard-earned money.
Yeah, and especially for you listening that own a business, which is a fairly complex asset, but someday you might sell that business for a large amount of cash, for instance, and all of a sudden that cash is sitting in a bank account, and if that bank account is not well protected in some way, shape, or form, you could be a target for litigation easily can be attached if it's not protected properly. And one of the things that, you know, our listeners hate, Craig, is the notion of, you know, they do so much already for all of their employees. They have benefits, they have workers' comp insurance, they have a variety of different expenses and costs, and they wonder, you know, what can I do just for myself, especially when it comes to planning for retirement? And again, a lot of our listeners are family businesses where they're not necessarily going to sell to a big outside buyer. It might be a family transition, and they just need to know that there's some money put away successfully and protected so that they can access that for their retirement. So let's talk about this notion of personal retirement plans. And I think when we say that, a lot of people think, well, what do you mean, an IRA account? We're not talking about that. In this conversation, anyways, let's talk about what is a personal retirement plan, as you refer to it.
A personal retirement plan is a really, really interesting tool that's available, as far as I know, only to Californians. And California is not an extraordinarily debtor-friendly state by and large, and generally most of the laws are burdensome on the business owners. This is one exception, and it is a gem of a little law that most people don't really know about. It is not a 401k. It's not an IRA. It's a non-qualified plan that any California resident can set up, and it basically allows you to convert assets, and it's very flexible as to what assets you can use to fund one of these things, from non-exempt to exempt. So exemption planning is the highest level of asset protection, and we started this conversation talking about offshore tools. This is done entirely locally, or entirely in the state of California. You can use a local bank, you can use local assets, and it's a completely different approach to asset protection. When you're going offshore, you're basically saying to your creditor, I'm not collectible. These assets are no longer mine, or to the extent you might be able to trace them to me, they're out of your reach. Where this is a completely different philosophy. The philosophy here is, yeah, the assets are there. They belong to the potential judgment debtor, but they're just off the table. They're just not subject to being seized in any kind of legal proceeding.
Interesting. So there must be some complex steps to accomplish that. And again, most people that think about anything having to do with anything called a retirement plan think, well, what is this? Do I have to do it for everybody? Do I have to do it for what if I already have a 401k or something like that? Tell us what some of the differences are from that the qualified plan versus, as you call it, the non-qualified plan, which is a tax term.
It doesn't affect the qualified plans, and you mentioned the tax term, so it's probably worth, I mean, most people know what we're talking about, but by a qualified plan, it's something that qualifies to exist pursuant to a statute called ERISA, and generally the qualified plans give you some kind of tax advantage. This California private retirement plan doesn't give you any kind of, it's tax neutral, so it's not going to save you tax, it's not going to cost you tax. But in exchange for that, it's extraordinarily versatile in some other areas. With qualified plans, you're limited to how much you can use to fund them per year. With this plan, you're not. So if you've gotten a late start, if you're in your 50s or 60s and you're behind and you need to fund it with a large sum of money in a lump sum, you can do that. Again, unlike qualified plans where you have to consider other employees in the company, this one you can set it up just for you, the business owner, or key people in the company or in the organization. You don't have to make it available to everybody. It's extraordinarily versatile in that way. And again, as to the classes of assets that you can use to fund it, which is virtually anything that you're not presently consuming. So you can't put your current residence in it because you're living there and you're consuming it. But you can put virtually anything else.
Yeah, and a lot of people would say, well, you know, with my qualified plan, I get a tax deduction going in, but the downside is that you have to, if you have employees, you have to include eligible employees in your calculations. And if you're trying to put away a lot, you're going to hit a limit at some point as to how much you can put aside on at least an annual basis for a qualified plan. And again, within the non-qualified plan like this, it sounds like you can always use a tax-deferred type of a vehicle if you're looking for tax advantages on the growth and distribution of your assets. Like some people turn to life insurance policies or annuities or things like that if they want tax deferral, or it sounds like you can put just about anything you want into it, right?
Excellent point. Yes, you can, and many people do, and those are the kind of assets they'll use to fund it. Just for that reason, you get your tax deferral, so it's almost having your cake and eating it too.
But the key of this really is that you exceed the limits established, and you can just do this for, you can single yourself out, or maybe even can you add in key employees if you want to just single out a few people in your company?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Each employee that you want to make a participant in the plan, you've got a master plan, a corporate plan, and each one can have a sub-trust. And yes, it's extraordinarily versatile in that respect. It can be just the owners. It can be key people. Again, it doesn't have any of the requirements that you'd find in a qualified plan.
Yeah, and that's becoming very, very, you know, because, you know, for most people that are business owners, they say, well, I get to a point and it's like, I feel like I've helped my employees. I've given them some kind of a program where they can put their own money in and I'll match it or maybe even make a contribution. But I need to do a lot more because my lifestyle's different, or I need to lock in key employees because if they leave, my hopes of selling my business might go down the tubes because they're the real true, you know, people that run the business, and I want to leave. When I sell my business, I want to leave,
right.
And I want to leave them behind, and I want to make sure they're tied in. So when we look at this PRP, the personal retirement plan, versus a qualified IRA or 401k, I think we've already talked about the tax differences. How difficult is it to set something like this up?
You need a third-party administrator, and you have to respect the plan just like you would an IRA or 401k. If you use it like a personal savings account or an ATM machine, it will fail if it's ever challenged. So the trick is, and here's the thing, and let me focus on a term that you just used. You mentioned lifestyle. And the policy behind this, and by the way, this is an old statute. It goes back to the 70s. It's been around for a long time, longer than ERISA has, in fact, is to maintain lifestyle. And that's the policy behind this. The state looks at it and says, if you can fund your lifestyle, we, the state, doesn't have to. So the key to making this work is to be able to lay a foundation that's what you're doing. I'm doing this to maintain my lifestyle. So what we do to set it up is we do a series of analytics where we determine and calculate with the assistance of a third-party administrator or partner that we work with to determine what your requirements are going to be at retirement. We lay the foundation for that. So if anybody were to come and challenge the plan, we can say, no, here's the lifestyle we're trying to preserve. And do the calculations based on that, how much you can put in, how much you can anticipate taking out post-retirement. And those are the requirements. You have to do the analytics to make sure that it's consummate with your lifestyle, and treat it like, you know, respect the integrity of the plan. Really is.
That's why you need a third party. Well, just like a pension plan has an actuary that determines things like life expectancy based on published tables that are out there, and income, you know, income needs based on your current income, maybe times some kind of a percentage, and then some kind of an inflation factor for determining. Those are some of the common factors, aren't they?
Precisely. And the other thing that's interesting about the California statute is it's fairly thin in retirement or in defining what is retirement. So it's a very flexible definition of retirement also. So you can, when the time comes, you're retired when you're retired. So you're not locked into, at a certain age, you have to take required minimum distributions and things like that. So it's there when you need it, and you can defer it until you need it.
So one of the key tenets I've seen behind these things is that, you know, you have to set the rules, and you have to follow what rules you set. Like you said, you can't just put it in for a couple years and then just take it out. There has to be kind of a set of rules around this, and that's consistent with the way the IRS treats all non-qualified deferred comp and those types of plans under Section 409A, they call it, in the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code. So you just basically have to have a framework, experts determining what your potential limits could or should be, and then from there, the dollars reside where you want them to be. But if you want tax benefits, you're looking for tax advantaged investments, I take it. And then the administrator basically is someone you go to and say, give me a report and pay me out when it's time to pay me out.
Exactly. And the administrator is making sure that you follow those rules. It's making sure that any necessary reporting is done. It's basically protecting the integrity of the plan.
Okay, so how airtight are these when it comes to the, we're talking about this exemption planning versus asset protection planning. How airtight are these if you are sued at some point?
If they're set up properly and you follow the rules, they're very good. And like any kind of asset protection or any kind of planning at all, the earlier you do it, the better. Unlike an offshore trust, and keeping in mind that the purpose of these things is always maintaining lifestyle post-retirement. You know, the purpose can never be primarily asset protection. And it's like any kind of asset protection planning. If you've got a giant lawsuit hanging over your head and you start scrambling around and go, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm going to lose everything. And you rush and set one of these things up, it probably is going to fail. Now, having said that, there is no prima facie rule that if you set it up in the midst of a crisis, it's automatically avoidable transaction or fraudulent transfer, like it might be with more conventional asset protection. If the case can be made that it is for lifestyle preservation post-retirement, you're probably okay. But the short answer to your question is the earlier you do it, the more formally you treat it, they become pretty they protect you. They're fairly strong. I mean, it's an example where the state literally has your back, and you don't see that very much.
You don't.
The state of California literally saying, "All right, you did this right. These assets are off the table. They are not in the discussion when you're talking about what kind of assets are exposed to creditors."
And usually, really in California, the business owner thinks the only thing they've got on their back is a target, not the help of the state of California.
So and this is the one beautiful exception to that.
Yeah, and so this is, this is not something you would likely hear about from your benefits broker, because this starts in a legal office, doesn't it?
Typically, yes, and there's not a huge financial incentive for financial planners to do these things. It really, frankly, it's just something that a lot of people just don't even know about.
Yes.
We lecture on this, and we lecture in front of attorneys and financial planners, and Jeff or I usually start the conversation with how many people have heard of these or used these, and it's shocking how very few people have not only not utilized them, but aren't even aware that they exist. And this statute goes back to, don't quote me, but it's the early 70s. I don't know the exact year, but it's been around for, you know, over 40 years. And they're not extraordinarily common.
Now, if someone, for instance, a typical business owner pays themselves a nominal, you know, reasonable but nominal wage, they don't max out their wages because of tax purposes, for instance, and would they do well to consult with someone like yourself well in advance so they can get those numbers right before they start approaching their funding of something like this?
Yeah, when the first step we do is we run the analytics I mentioned before, and we calculate what is reasonable in terms of being able to take out of the plan post-retirement, and that's an excellent point. A lot of that is going to rely on your current wages. So if you're making $150,000 a year today and someone were to challenge the plan that's going to pay you $300,000 after you retire, it's difficult to justify that. I think it would be a fair question to say, well, why do you need $300,000 after retire when you've lived during your working career $150,000? So those are all issues that we would discuss before setting up the plan and put you in the most advantageous position to make it work for you.
So let's say our typical audience member is a baby boomer who's saying, you know, I want to get ready for my exit in the next 5 years, and it might be I want to turn the business over to my children, for instance, or my key employees, because 8 out of 10 business owners have a tough time finding a market for their business. And to do that, you know, I'm going to have to risk my future cash flow that I'm going to have to risk that my kids can make a go of this business. So in advance of that, I'd like to start putting some money somewhere where if it doesn't work out for whatever reason, at least I'm protected from potential future claims. Would this be a pretty good place to get started in their planning and start thinking about?
It would be a great place to start. And one thing with asset protection planning in general, and I think there's a lot of it's simpatico with the show, in that when you exit your business under any number of scenarios, you're exposed you know, for whatever reason, be it the next generation runs it improperly or the people you sell it to have a problem with the financials you provided them when they're doing due diligence or whatever. It's not uncommon, and we see it here a lot, that people who have gotten out of businesses have to deal with liability arising out of that business years after they're gone. With one of these plans, you're in a real good position to where that, you know, the effect of something like that would be mitigated.
So once again, you've demonstrated how the Jeffrey Verdon Law Group is ahead of the pack when it comes to helping business owners to think about these issues. That, you know, just because you sell your business, that doesn't mean you're in the clear. That means you're at risk. I guess in the mergers and acquisition world, Craig, they say that the first check cashes, the second one's late, and the third one might not come. But the worst scenario is you may get served to take back what you've taken. So it's imperative that our listeners think about these types of strategies. And what's the best way for them to get in touch with you and talk about this?
You can give me a call. My direct dial is 949-333-8149. We're in Newport Beach, 949-333-8149. Or go to our website, jmvlaw.com, jmvlaw.com. We'd be happy to have a preliminary conversation on the phone, have you in, talk about what's on your mind, and see how we can put you in a better position than you're in now.
Well, the Jeffrey M. Verdon Law Group has long been a friend of this show, and Craig, I really appreciate you coming on once again and clarifying a topic that I think is on the mind of a lot of people. If it's not on your radar screen, it maybe should be. You ought to be thinking about some of the ways that you can protect your assets as you think about your exit. So, Craig, thank you once again for coming on the show and helping us out here. I really appreciate it.
Always my pleasure. And if I could say one more thing, just what you just said, I think is spot on. And if you have liquid assets that are just sitting out there, one of these plans just wraps them in a firewall, and it's just a better place to be than just to have them exposed. It's low hanging fruit to creditors. Lock them up.
Good advice. Thank you once again. I look forward to the next time we get to talk.
Likewise. Thank you, Bill.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.